When Robert Parrish grew up in Los Angeles in the early 1920s, the Hollywood studio lots were his playground. As a child, he was an actor in many films, including Charlie Chaplin's City Lights and the Our Gang comedies. Director John Ford became his mentor. Parrish acted in Ford's films, learned sound and film editing under his wing, and later worked on some of the director's greatest films, such as The Grapes of Wrath. During World War II, Parrish and Ford made films for the U.S. Intelligence Agency, the Office of Strategic Services. Robert Parrish became one of Hollywood's top film editors. He won an Academy Award for his work on Body and Soul in 1947. He worked with many of Hollywood's most illustrious stars. He directed Rita Hayworth in the film Fire Down Below, joined Ernest Hemingway at the bullfights in Spain, and he once served as Mae West's bodyguard. Parrish has written a 2-volume memoir of his Hollywood days, Growing Up in Hollywood, and the newly published Hollywood Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I spoke with him at the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him about the first movie he remembers seeing.
First movie was a Doug Fairbanks picture, The Black Pirate, and I saw it in Columbus, Georgia, where I grew up, and I was about 6 or 8 years old, I think. And I never forgot it.
Did it give you a sense of what the pictures were going to be like?
Well, it never occurred to me that I'd be involved in pictures in any way. I only wanted to be involved in the one that I was looking at. And in that one, Doug Fairbanks was standing on a sail of a sailing boat, a spar, way up above the deck of the boat. And he pulled out a knife and put it in his mouth for a minute, then smiled down at the people below. Then he took it out of his mouth and he jumped onto the sail and put the knife into the sail and rowed down and did away with the pirates that were on the deck. I never forgot it.
Now, you moved to Hollywood from Georgia, and the Hollywood lots became your playground. Did your parents mind that, or did they think of it as an education for you?
Well, I don't think they minded it because as soon as there were 4 kids in the family, and this family wasn't very well off, and my father traveled, he wasn't home a lot. And so shortly after we got there, we began to work and became a source of income for the family. And so I don't think they minded it at all. We worked as extras, as child extras, and then as we grew older, we worked at in the swing gang on the back lots and things like that. We became part of the industry.
What was your first confrontation with the Hollywood star system?
Oh, I guess the one that was the most memorable was a man came into the school that I was going to, the grammar school, and asked who wanted to work in a picture with Charlie Chaplin. Well, I certainly knew who he was. And I held up my hand, and then they said, well, only boys, because some girls held up their hands, too. And they said, only boys that can shoot a pea shooter. So they eliminated all but 2 of us and took us over to Charlie Chaplin's studio and introduced us to Mr. Chaplin. And I watched him direct some parts of this movie, which was called City Lights. And then when it came around to tell us what to do, or to these 2 boys that were going to shoot a pea shooter at him, he did it for so long that we were finally bored with it. But he wanted to do it himself. He wanted to do everything himself. He would be the boys shooting the pea shooter, and he'd run out to the middle of the street and put his hand on his head and pretend that he was hit with a pea shooter.
You mean he wanted to play all the parts?
He wanted to play all the parts. He wanted to do everything. And so it was, finally, he reluctantly said to Raleigh Totherow, the cameraman, well, I guess we better shoot it. And he always said that after he had done the parts for the leading lady, the heavy, the kids in the street, and he was reluctant to finally say, well, I guess we have to let them do it now. That's what I remember about meeting a big star.
Yeah, about the style of his directing, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You really made the rounds as a child extra. You worked with Chaplin and Douglas Fairbanks, and then you got picked for Our Gang.
Yes. Our Gang, they had 4 or 5, maybe 6 kids that were stars in Our Gang. In my time, the fat boy was Joe Cobb, and the little black boy was Farina. And There was a little girl named Mary Kornman and Mickey Daniels, but they were the main actors in our gang. Then they had a backup group for each one of these kids in case they got sick or they had trouble with their mothers or whatever. I was chosen as one of the backup kids, and we would be the enemy team if it was a football game or if they needed for Joe Cobb to hit with a ball peen hammer, we would be the ones. But they put us under contract, and I stayed there for about a year.
You know, the kids, as I look back on it now, always seem to have this sort of set responses to certain kinds of things. Did you do that spontaneously, or did they teach you that stuff?
No, they taught it to us. When they had the interview, the director, Robert McGowan, who was a very dour man. He never laughed at all at anything. I never saw him laugh. He wore a derby. He had a pockmarked face. And he came into this room where we were going to be interviewed. There were about 15 kids there, and they wanted 5. And he said, now, look here, you kids, listen to me. I'm going to show you some things you're going to have to do if you work in our gang. And if you can do them, you'll work in our gang. And if you can't, you're out. You got it? And we were kids that some at 6 years old or something. He said, the first thing I'm going to tell you is how to do a dough. And so we watched, and he then held his mouth open and said, dough, and shook his head. And he said, when I tell you to do a dough, that's what I want. You got it? And so we kind of said yes, and he said, all right, let's see all of you do it. So he said, do it. And we all did it, and he eliminated 7 of the kids right away. He said, you can't do doughs. Then he said, now we're going to go to double doughs, which is the same as a single dough, except that you shake your head twice. You go, dough, dough. And then one of them was called a flip-flop, and one was called a butterfly wings, which is, say you did get hit with a stick, or you stood up straight and put your hands across your chest so that your fingers showed in the back and flipped them like a butterfly and then fell on the floor. And he was very impressed with the way I did that. And he said, you're all right, kid, you're going to be one of them. He said, I never saw anybody do a butterfly that good the first time. So his direction for the year after that was he would point or do hold up 4 fingers or 2 fingers, and the kids, they had this language going.
Yeah, he would signal you.
Oh, sure.
Did you get the sense that he liked kids?
Not particularly. I never felt any particular warmth for him. Yeah. I once saw a picture of him. I did see a picture of him smiling once with Mickey Daniels. So I guess he had Mickey Daniels on his shoulders and seemed to be liking him. But it was a routine, more or less. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of fun off between shooting.
Yeah.
The kids playing and so on.
A director, film editor, and actor Robert Parrish is my guest. Weren't you also an extra on the sinking of the Titanic movie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one where they tried to get you to cry?
Yes. as the Titanic was going down, Charles Boyer and the leading people were involved in some certain things, but other people had to line up along the deck at the rail, and Frank Borzage was the director, and we were supposed to sing Nearer My God to Thee and then cry. And he was trying people out to see if they could cry, and so I sneaked off into the men's room where they had some Lux soap. Lux soap was in all the studios of men's room and to ladies' rooms. They had a contract with Lux soap. And I put some Lux soap under my fingernails, and when it came to me and they pointed to me, I had put some soap in my eyes, and it made me cry, so I was hired and given a little bit part in it.
So they loved you too there.
Yes, yeah. Sure. Now, my mother had told me, always say yes. Whatever I don't care what they ask you, you say yes. And If they ask you if you have a gray suit and you don't, I'll make one for you the night before you go to work.
You mean whether you could do it or not?
Always. Always. Just say yes.
Did you get in trouble when they found out you couldn't?
Quite often. Well, they asked me if I could cry, and I couldn't cry, but I found a way to do it. I had said yes, I could cry. That's the first thing they ask when they phoned and ask us to come for the interview.
You finally got sort of a full job working in the cutter's room and working with sound editing and negatives and that kind of thing. Did that help you later on when you became a director, having had that experience?
Oh, yes. At that particular time in the industry, it's changed, of course, since. For example, when sound came in, the word was more important than the mechanics of cutting, but the word around Hollywood was that cutters make good directors, and quite often they would say the cutter actually makes the picture. And I used to say that until I became a director, and then I said it's nonsense. But yes, I did work as a sound effects editor and a music editor, and then finally as a feature picture editor.
Now, isn't that where you met John Ford, the director, when you were working as a cutter?
No, I met John Ford when I was a little boy, and he was directing a picture called Mother McCree, and I was an extra in a schoolroom or something, and he liked to hire families with a lot of kids, the Watsons and the Parishes and so on, so that he would only have to deal with one of the mothers. So he could fill a whole schoolroom and have only five mothers, and the schoolroom was full of kids. So once he got, once one got to work with him, and this went for stars or crew or Cameron, whatever it is, he liked to keep those people with him. So he would, over a period of years, whenever he would have kid extras, these four or five families would get called. So I met him then, and I knew him for a long time. And then later I was working in The Informer as an extra. And he was a peculiar, strange Irishman, and he never really talked very much to the kids. But he had me do a bit on this. One day we were IRA members, and the next we were the British Black and Tans. And he had me do a bit, and he came to me the next day, and he said, I just saw those rushes on that little thing you did yesterday. And he said, you know something, you can't act. And I said, well, Mr. Ford, I was then about 15, I guess. I said, I've been acting for you for a long time. He said, no, but you've never been on the screen for longer than 3 or 4 seconds. Now, in this thing, you are. He said, we got to do something about that. And a couple of days later, he came to me. He said, when you finished on the picture, which was a short, didn't take long to shoot The Informer, he took me to the cutting room to a man named Billy Hamilton and said, Billy, this guy will be better in the cutting room. He's certainly no good in front of the camera. And that's how I got in the cutting room.
Yeah. What was your first lesson with him, though, when you were in the cutting room? I remember you saying something about him saying to you, come over here, stand next to this camera. I want to tell you a little something about how it goes.
Oh, well, that was after I was a sound effects cutter working at Fox. And I used to sneak on the stage and hang around and see, watch him, because I wanted to be a director. And so one day I went on, they were shooting, I forget what it was, but he asked the assistant director, his brother, to bring me over, and he had a finder. The finder on a motion picture camera is practically a piece of steel about 2.5 feet long. It's really the lens, except you can take it off the camera and look through it and see what you're going to shoot. And so he was looking through this, getting ready to make his setup on the scene, and he said, that you, Parrish? I said, yes, sir. And he said, you standing close enough to hear me talk? I said, yes. He said, well, you asked me a couple of years ago about how to be a director. Here's your first lesson. He said, get behind this thing and put it over both your eyes and start thinking. And think about what you're going to shoot, because most of the times you come in the morning, you don't know what you're going to shoot. And while you're thinking, time will go on and somebody, some stooge on the set, will phone the front office and say, it's 9:30 and he hasn't got a shot yet. And then somebody from the production office will come down, and he'll stand just about where you're standing. And I stood there. I was taking in all this. And he said, when you're sure he's very close, you swing the finder around hard, which he did. And he hit me in the forehead and broke the skin. And he said, don't take your eyes from behind it. Just say you're still working and looking around. And he said, they won't come back anymore. He said, that's your first lesson. Get the hell back in the cutting room where you belong.
And you stood there bleeding?
I was bleeding, and I went up to the first aid place. And I will say that I was working on sound effects. Then he came in the back door. I had was working late. And on that day, and I had a bandage on my head, and he came to the back of the cutting room and stood there for a while. And he said, are you having trouble with that sequence? And I said, yes, sir, I am. He said, then you're doing it wrong. He said, the way I shoot stuff, it fits. You don't have to cut it. You just splice it together. And he turned around and walked about away.
My guest is Robert Parrish. He grew up in Hollywood, appeared in films as a child, and went on to win an Oscar for his editing of the film Body and Soul. He's written two-volume memoirs, Growing Up in Hollywood and Hollywood Doesn't Live Here Anymore. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Director, film editor, and actor Robert Parrish is my guest. You know, when you tell that story about John Ford, and I think of the stories about some of the other old Hollywood directors, what is it about them that seem to have this ability to, almost an exquisite ability, to dismiss people?
Well, yes, that's part of the job, but you see, my experience was that all Hollywood directors are different, that there are no two alike. William Wyler was not like von Sternberg, and Ford certainly wasn't like anybody else. And so they can dismiss people, but they do it in different ways. I remember William Wyler was asked to come to USC Film School and talk to the students. And he was then the top director in Hollywood, I guess, one of the top. So he called me because I'd been to school at USC, and he said, now, what are these kids going to ask me? And I said, well, they'll ask you a lot of stuff, but finally, one of them will say, how do you become a director? That's the key to the whole thing. Then you have to think of what to say. Mm-hmm. So Willie said, will you come with me? And I said, yes. I went there, and they asked questions, and I sat in the front row. And finally, a Burmese boy got up in the back and said, Mr. Wyler, my question is, how do you become a director? And Willie looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, I can't tell you how other people became a director, because all directors are different. I'll tell you my experience, and you probably can get something from that that will help you become a director. And they all said expectantly, he said, first, be born in Alsace-Lorraine. He said, second, preferably in the city of Mulhouse. He said, then, and third, this is very important, listen carefully, have an uncle who owns Universal Pictures in California. Then he said, you write him a letter. And he said, he won't answer it. Then you go to your mother and say, will you call your brother at Universal Pictures and ask if I can come out and work in the studio, which she did. Then you'll get a kind of a steerage ticket. And when you meet your uncle in Universal Studio, he will say, you now owe us so much money, and we'll pay you $10 a week until you've paid that off, and you can sleep behind the prop shop. And he said, you're in the studio then. The most important thing is to get your foot in. He said, after that, just a question of being lucky for the rest of your life. Well, these kids sat there. But I remember that because his point was that every director did it differently, and they fired people. He dismissed these kids with this story. That's dismissal, if I ever heard one.
It's a great story. Yeah. You know, when I think about Ford again, he made some of the greatest Hollywood films, but there was this story about him that he almost never moved the camera. So was that part of his genius?
I don't know if it was his genius, but it was his way of shooting a picture. He was not a man for any mysteries about technique. He's the first person I ever saw who was shooting a scene with Ward Bond, And he at a certain point, he said, keep the camera rolling, and he put his hand in front of the camera. And so Ward Bond went on talking. And what he meant was, to the cutter, this was a signal, don't use whatever this, because Ward is lousy in this part of it. And then he'd take his hand away when he thought Ward was good. Now, that was complete control of the mechanics, and his pictures were shot with very little footage. There was very little left over.
Now, how about you when you first started directing? Were you scared the first time?
Oh, yes. Dick Powell, the actor, gave me a chance to direct a melodrama that he wanted to do. And I went to see him, and I said, you know, I've never directed anything before. And he said, there's nothing to it. He said, even I could do it. But he said, I'm so busy playing the stock market and doing other buying real estate, I haven't got time. He said, you just come on there, pretend you know what you're doing, and I'll pretend I know you know what you're doing, and we'll make the picture. And we did. And it was a modest success, but at least I was then a director.
How often did you bring your films in on budget?
Most all the time. One that kind of got away was Casino Royale, which was I didn't direct it. I directed a section of it. They decided to make a James Bond picture with a new director and a new James Bond in each section. And John Huston had... David Niven is his James Bond. I had Peter Sellers, but I also had Orson Welles as Smersh, and they hated each other. And Orson was good in the morning, and no good in the afternoon, for whatever reason. As soon as Peter heard this, he had his agent come in and say, "I can really only be good in the eyes." So the picture closed down, and so that one went over budget, way over budget.
Director, film editor, and actor Robert Parrish is my guest. Did that happen often? Did you, on any other occasions, have leading people who were not speaking to each other?
Well, there's little things in every movie, I guess, that some people don't get along.
How do you get them to work together, though?
Well, in that case, I had to agree. Peter said he wouldn't come back on the set if he had to speak to Orson Welles, and they had long scenes together. So I had to devise ways where Schmersh would be sitting up behind a wall talking to James Bond. That was the worst. That's the worst job, that I ever ran across, of trying to... Actually, Orson was marvelous, and Peter was a peculiar, talented, funny man, but he was strange.
Now, when you got the Academy Award for Body and Soul in 1947, I was thinking about that, and I wondered if you felt the pressure, as some people do, to try and do it again, to get another Academy Award.
Well, of course, I was delighted to win the Academy Award, but I didn't... I kind of thought that I'd get one every year. I never got another one, but I did, of course, aim to try to do the best work I could. And the following year, I was nominated for a movie called All the King's Men, but I didn't win it. And that disappointed me because I thought the cutting job on that was much better than the one on Body and Soul. So I don't think that... it's necessary. It's a very hard thing to judge, and a lot of things are involved in it.
When you were directing in the 1950s, and the House Un-American Activities Committee was in full swing, did that make life difficult for you?
Well, it wasn't a happy time for anybody, but I was, apolitical. I was so busy trying to get ahead and to cut pictures and to get jobs, that I wasn't really aware as I should have been at the beginning of the period. I did become aware when they had a big sort of scandalous meeting of the Directors Guild. It was the first one that I attended as a member of the Directors Guild, where. Joe Mankiewicz and Cecil B. DeMille had a battle, and they were extreme opposites politically. And DeMille wanted to get rid of Mankiewicz. He was president of the guild, and all kinds of people got up and gave speeches and tears, and Reuben Mamoulian said, this is the first time I've been embarrassed to be an American, and one kid said, I worked for Mr. DeMille since I was a kid, and unless he takes this back and what he said about Joe Mankiewicz, I'm leaving the guild and all that. Finally, John Ford got up, chewing his handkerchief, and hadn't said a word to the whole meeting, which had lasted over 3 hours. And he said, I know that Cecil B. DeMille knows more about what to show people to get them into the theater than anybody in this room, and I respect him for that. He's a fine filmmaker. But he said, I don't like you, C.B. The room came to a dead stop. And he said, I think you've maligned Joe Mankiewicz tonight. And I hereby move that you resign from the board of the guild. Matter of fact, he said, I think we all should resign and start over. And that's a motion. And it was carried. Mm-hmm. So then I knew that there were strong differences of opinion politically, and a lot of careers were ruined. And I think now, as I look back on it, it was shocking.
I've enjoyed this time together so much. Thank you so much.
I have too. Thank you.
My guest has been Robert Parrish. His memoirs are titled Growing Up in Hollywood and Hollywood Doesn't Live Here Anymore. They're published by Little Brown. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air.